You are listening to Around Comics, episode 248, brought to you by InStockTrades.com, Cadence Comic Art, and Netflix. Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week a revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you are in the area, please drop by. Hey there, folks. Christopher Niesman here. Let's get you introduced to this all-new panel on Around Comics.
New week, new people.
Except me,
I'm here.
Except for you, Tom. Yes, you're always here.
I had enough vacation.
Yeah.
My month off from the show.
Yeah, except for that 1 month, you're always here. Yeah. Mr. Tom Caters.
Hello.
We had Elliot Serrano on last week, and Dave Mathis. Can't forget Dave. And Elliot was going to stick around and do a second show with us and talk about Ash Saves Obama from
Dynamite. And
you
offended him.
And then I said something. Elliot stormed off.
He told us
that he would never be back. No, Elliot conceded his spot and decided to go home. He was very gracious because we had a couple people that just popped in, which is one of the great things about the show is that you never know who's going to show up on
Street
a Friday
toughs,
night.
Just it's roving gangs of.
We actually
comic book professionals roaming the streets.
We got an awesome story about a homeless guy that was out back, which I'll recount to you in a little bit. But lo and behold, we're in the comic shop tonight, and none other than Mr. Tony Akins.
Ta-da.
The artist of, among other great things, Jack of Fables.
That is correct.
Tony, one of our favorite guests that pops in from time to time.
I am a favorite.
You are a favorite. Yes, you are. Absolutely. And another gentleman who is from the deep well of Chicago talent, even though we have never had him on the show before. Chances are, if you read comics, you have read a comic book that is colored by this man. He is the incredibly talented Mr. Paul Mounts.
Hello.
How are you?
Okay.
I'm so glad that you came by.
Yeah, it was close. I almost didn't make it. So now I feel guilty because I took a spot from someone. So.
Chris did offend him. We covered that as a joke, but really, he did.
You offended him just so I could sit here, right?
It's like, Elliot, we got everything covered, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, I live out in the suburbs, so let me get home early. So Elliot is a king.
Like everyone, they're desperate to leave this as quickly as possible.
Yeah. What you'll find, Paul, is that Tom, as we get closer to the hour mark, Tom will start hurrying things along.
Let's go. Yeah.
It's like, all right, time to go home. I have like Brewers baseball recaps to watch.
I gotta watch a condensed baseball game when I get home. You know, it's all the lights off in my apartment.
Green Bay Packers pregame.
Yeah,
coverage.
I gotta watch preseason football or something. I just really just want to get out.
T-bowing through the fourth, the boring part.
Oh, it's the best way to watch a sporting event is skipping through the commercials.
But we will talk about Paul's illustrious career as we get going here. But first, I want to mention that this episode of Around Comics is, of course, brought to you by InStockTrades.com, where waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades offers a huge selection of collected editions you need. InStockTrades is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 do, in fact, ship for free. And right now, we are offering our book club selection. It's the new book club selection.
Oh, okay.
That's right. It is, you just finished up the Justice League International.
I like you have to give me clues like...
We haven't recorded this
episode.
We
haven't recorded the next thing yet. You're looking at me like I'm confused. I am confused.
Just roll with me, Tom.
All right.
You have just finished the Justice League International Volume 1 by Giffen, DeMatteis, and Kevin McGuire. And now we are moving on to a little bit more of the JLA.
Just the nerdiest. I picked the nerdiest comic book.
I'm so excited about this.
JLA Avengers by Busiek and Perez. So it's like the nerdiest thing you could possibly read.
I was like, is he going to pick Marvel? Is he going to pick DC?
I picked both.
You did.
And
win.
So
everyone
we can all
wins.
Sit around and wallow in our minutia.
Yes, it's going to be awesome.
I know, yeah. It's what I do.
And In-Stock Trades, as they always do for our book club selections, has increased their discount to an amazing 47% off the cover price. You can get this ridiculously pretty and awesome JLA Avengers story.
If you like the JLA or Avengers.
It's all there,
If you're one of those people that holds on to some weird childhood grudge that you will only read Marvel or DC, then you should probably read this. Yes. It's good, you had all the bad ones where you had characters mix and it's just kind of stupid. This one was actually entertaining.
I like the Teen Titans X-Men crossover. I thought that was cool.
Who drew that?
Why are you looking at me like that, Tom? Simonson.
I'm trying to remember if Simonson? I liked it.
It was
I think Claremont wrote it.
Claremont, yeah. It was good. I liked it.
It was all right. No, whatever.
No. Well, you can get this for 47% off the cover price. It's yours for a minuscule $10.69. All right.
See it in Perez, it's dense.
Oh yeah.
That's like
it's a lot of story
Perez
and a lot of characters.
In just about every single thing that's ever happened in a Avengers and JLA book into like,
at that time it is every character that has ever been a part of the Avengers or the JLA. It is a ridiculous.
He's obsessive
amount.
Compulsive.
Yeah. He wants to draw every character that's ever been in a comic book.
There are entire websites that annotate that book. As a matter of fact, they annotate panel by panel as to what characters are interacting and their history and everything else.
Yeah, I mean that's detailed.
Yeah. Before we get moving
Let's
on to
go,
the comic
nerds.
Book talk, music. This episode, one of the bands that my wife really turned me on to.
Oh God!
My wife has much better music taste than I do, Tom. Okay. Catherine Wheel this week.
Oh
yeah,
yeah.
Catherine Wheel is. Oh shit, your wife does have better music.
Catherine Wheel's great.
Catherine Wheel's great band. Yeah. Great band. So
they're gonna get another episode of George Strait.
No, that's I love George
nothing
Strait.
Against George Strait. Yeah, I always just randomly pick something that I think you would pick, and I'm always right. You're like, I was thinking about picking that. I know you so
Last
well.
Last week, Afghan Wigs. This week, Catherine Wheel.
So Catherine Wheel's no longer together, right?
No.
They're clearly a 90s, but one of my favorite 90s.
I think Rob Dickinson's doing some solo work.
Okay.
He's awesome.
All right, yeah.
He's right there with Greg Dooley from last week as a guy that's like, man, I wish I could be him.
See, I don't keep track of the bands when the guys go single. You do, because you gave me the Shriek Back what's his name?
Barry Adamson?
Thank
no,
you.
not Barry Adamson, sorry.
Yeah.
Barry Andrews.
Barry Andrews.
Barry Andrews.
Yeah.
From where?
From Shriekback, back in the 80s. And club music, and then Barry Andrews is like, he was also part of XTC.
Well, yeah, they had, all those bands had a kind of a history. Okay. They all crossed over.
Yeah,
so.
But he like went solo and then kind of went kind of dark and moody. So
I like dark and moody.
As opposed to that light, airy Shriekback stuff.
Hey, any song that works Parthenogenesis into it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have a music.
You just said Parthenogenesis?
Yes.
What's your word for this episode?
Oh my!
You always have a word.
I always have a word for for this episode.
It's been cudgel?
Cudgel, yeah.
What was the other one?
Brian Bowling sent Tilth back to me.
Tilth. Cudgel. So what is this one?
This one will be, let's say, Meander. Meander is a good.
That's a good description of the show.
Yeah,
it's really. Very meandering.
Yeah, it's meandering.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, Paul, because we have never had you on the show before, and you're a colorist, and so most people recognize your work without recognizing your work. And so what's familiarize with you, because colorists I describe like colorists and letterers and to some extent inkers as kind of the offensive lineman of comic books, is that if it's good, people almost don't notice it. If it's bad, it jumps off the page. And so you are a guy that is so good at your craft that I know that people
that one knows me. That's
because you're very
you don't fuck it up all the time.
I mean, it kind of sounds like a dick thing to say, but it's like you're so good that nobody knows you. But no,
if you sucked, you'd be famous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, infamous.
Infamous.
Maybe.
Everybody be like, oh God, and they're Paul Mount's book. But, here
but
we go.
But I think that people that pay attention to colorists and good colorists know you. You're a household colorist name for comics.
Chris, lay it off a bit.
You've done okay. Let's just cut to it. What are some of the books that you're probably most well known for coloring?
I worked on the first Ultimates run with Brian Hitch. Actually, I've colored pretty much everything Brian Hitch has done in the last 6 or 7 years, other than the second Ultimate set, which Laura Martin did.
You worked on Fantastic Four then?
Yeah, so I worked on the Ultimates and Fantastic Four, doing Reborn, Captain America Reborn right now. And let's see, what else? I worked on the Micro. I've been on Fantastic Four for about 7 years now. Actually, if I stay on another, I think, year and a half, 2 years, I'll have done more issues of FF than Stan and Jack did.
Wow.
So I'm coming up close.
Damn.
Jesus Christ. Make it
through, so.
That's awesome.
You have to toss your name into the discussion then.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time it's like Stan, Jack, and Paul will be in the back. Yeah. And me, bitches! Yeah.
But it's color. It's just coloring, so it's not quite what Stan and Jack did. Yeah. But
well, I mean, coloring is so important. Paul and I worked together years ago, and I've always lamented not having Paul color my work. And usually I look at something that he's done, and I weep. Just because it's, I do. Seriously.
Not to disparage whoever's coloring Tony now.
This is the show of left-handed compliments. Thank you, everybody. When I look at Paul's work, I
weep. See your work, I break down like a goddamn child.
I do. Well, okay, maybe weep is wrong. I piss myself. That's what I do. Wanted. Paul color Wanted.
Oh, you have color Wanted.
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah, over J.G. Jones.
Yeah, and it, I mean, just beautiful, beautiful work, you know. I don't know what to say. He's like the best in the business.
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned. You know, and being a colorist, and we've talked to guys on the show like Jason Millay, who's who's another Chicago guy, and it's Dave Stewart, you know, another guy, another Chicago guy. But there are these names of these colorists that you get to know, and it's just they get put on these projects because you know that they're trustworthy colorists, that you know they're going to understand it. I see what Dave Stewart is doing on Detective Comics right now. And that book, I mean, it's Rucka, it's J.H. Williams, and Dave Stewart is definitely a big part of that book.
Right.
And coloring and lettering are so integral to the comic book creative process. And I think that people overlook those parts of the process. And undeservedly so. It's such an important part. A good colorist brings so much to a book. Now, how long have you been doing it?
Wow. Let's see. Did the first comic book work probably in the late 80s.
Okay,
First and Now Comics back when they were here in Chicago.
So you made the digital jump, were you?
Yeah, I was coloring Blue Line at the time. And as a matter of fact, one of the first books I did at Marvel was The Adventures of Captain America over Kevin Maguire.
Wow.
Which was the first prestige kind of format book that Marvel did, and that was all Blue Line color. And of course now I'm working on Reborn, so I get kind of bookends things now. But
so you had to learn your craft and then relearn your craft.
Yeah, I switched to computers about October of 94, and
so
literally
it must have been traumatic. It was, oh shit.
Well, it was interesting because I had never touched a computer at all at that point, and literally the business changed overnight. I was learning how to even learn how to work a computer and coloring my first job the day that my computers were installed that first time. So,
wow.
Do you look back at it and are like, oh, I didn't know what
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's Dark Knight Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, I think, infamously a comic that had really just incredibly vivid colors to it, and I think that, you know, Lynn Varley colored that, and I think was going through the process of, oh shit, how do I do this computer coloring?
Well, I think that was a lot of it. There's a lot of stuff she wanted to do on that, and I think she got a lot of crap for it. But
it was a new process.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell she was learning the computers while she was doing it. It seemed. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but there was a lot of effects in there that you see people do when they first get their computer and they're learning filters. Ooh, Photoshop filters everywhere.
And of course, computers of the day only had 1,000 colors. So she only had, you know, like 150 shades of neon yellow to choose from.
Well, that's what my mom asked when I first started using computers. She says, what happens when they run out? How do you refill it?
Oh, mom, you're drunk.
Well, I'm a graphic designer in my day job. And so I was lucky enough that I graduated in 1994 or so. Mm. And so I landed right kind of at the beginning when computers had really become the standard in the design world. It's mm-hmm. you know, and there were a lot of people that kind of got caught in between of being traditional keyline production artist and then designing on the computer. And you know, comics are print. And so I always kind of wondered what the process was of people trying to make that crossover at the time. If you had started working in 86 or 88, that by the time 1994 or 96 rolls around, it's like, shit, we're doing all this on computers.
Did you look at your work and weep?
it was definitely a big jump, and I mean, I certainly don't miss doing all the airbrushing and cutting of friskets and all that, and sneezing. I was sneezing multicolors for years. You know, people thought I was diseased. My hands always are stained with dyes and paints and everything.
It's true. I miss that. Yeah. It's true. I remember.
Yeah. People that have no idea what he's talking about. Whenever you use an airbrush,
what was the old process? As someone who doesn't know so much, what was the old process of coloring something before computers?
I mean, originally comics were, you know, just done in a four-color process where everything was coded and they'd send them out to production houses and they would cut ruby lith for the four plates. By the time I was doing it, it had moved up to what was called blue lines, where the original art was reproduced twice, once in a light blue line on an illustration board and once in black line on an acetate overlay. And then you could paint on the illustration board, put the acetate overlay on it, and it would be almost like a full-painted comic. That's kind of how Steve Olaf was doing stuff on Weird World and the Marvel Super Specials back in the 70s and 80s. Things like that. And there's always problems with that because the registration would always be off. They would scan the thickness of the board was different than the thickness of the acetate, so nothing would register right. The reproduction was never quite right, you know, because the light from the laser would go through transparent colors different than opaque colors. And you have
that's
more control.
Why 70s comics look shitty.
Well, this was more of the 80s and 90s stuff, early 90s stuff. By the time we were switched over to computers, you know, it gives you a lot more control because we're doing the separations really at the same time too.
I remember when I first started, I took an airbrush class in college because airbrushing was still a part of commercial art.
You had a lot of Lamborghini posters.
Oh yeah, actually old classic cars. I got a great one. You do chrome. Chrome's easy, but kind of what Paul was talking about blowing out colors out of your nose. It's you know, an airbrush is basically vaporizing paint, and so you lay down paint as almost like a powder out of a pen.
And you're breathing spray paint all day, basically.
And so yeah, you're breathing this awesome. In, and it scared the shit out of me. I had this old classic car that I was airbrushing. It was cherry red, and so I'm painting this for like 12 hours in my trailer in college. And so I wake up the next morning, I go to the bathroom, and I blow my nose, and it's just like this crusty red. I'm like, oh, my God, my brains are coming out of my nose.
Fucking brain hemorrhage.
Yeah, and a lot of what we'd use in comics was this Dr. Martin dyes, which is incredibly concentrated watercolors. They come in these little, like, 3/4-ounce bottles. So when you breathe it, it would basically dye the inside of your nose for weeks at a time, dye your hands and everything else.
Dude, I remember all the Q-tips that used to lay around. I would help Paul cut frisket from time to time.
One of the guys who used to cut frisket for me still works with me today. Doing
now explain cutting frisket because
I have no idea what the hell frisket is.
First, when you airbrush, you want to mask off certain parts because you're spraying paint.
Like if you were like painting a wall, you would cover
it. You'd cover tape and stuff. Frisket's like a clear tape. And you cut little shapes. So I'd have an assistant who would cut out like all the backgrounds so I could airbrush the backgrounds or skies, things like that.
And frisket has a semi-adhesive back to it so you can pull it off and then paint an area and then
put
lay
it
down
and lift off another piece
and mask off different areas.
Crazy.
An incredibly tedious
that sounds
horrible
exciting.
Job.
It sounds like an exciting
it's
job.
Fucking boring God. And tedious and it's sucks.
Yeah, you lose a piece. You lose the frisket for like Superman's shield, you know, and you're like looking, where is it? It's stuck to me.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, you'd have a little piece of frisket stuck all over my arms and everything for days at a time.
Yeah.
Sounds like coloring was fun.
Yeah.
Well, this is one of the reasons that, you know, if you look at the history of comics, that it really was an assembly line, because there are so many tedious parts of the project that's why you had a penciler and inker, and then you had an entire production staff to do lettering. You had a letterer and all the people in the coloring. It's an assembly line.
It's still tedious
in different ways. It's just all those tools have become digitized.
I imagine putting
now.
The tape over your computer screen. It's got to be a tedious and difficult
It's been done. It's been done. I don't get it. When does it run out?
I'm out of yellow.
This portion of Around Comics is brought to you by Cadence Comic Art. You've heard me talk about buying original art on the show before, and now I want to let you know about the best place on the internet to find your next piece of original art. Whether you're looking for that one piece from your favorite artist, or you're wanting to build your own comics room art gallery, Cadence Comic Art is the first place you should go. CadenceComicArt.com has the easiest to navigate and most well-organized site for original comic art I've seen. You can find original art from some of Around Comics' favorite artists and past guests of the show, including Scotty Young, Mike Norton, Tim Seeley, Chris Burnham, Jamal Eigel, Jeremy Hahn, Ryan Stegman, Sean Murphy, Brent Schoonover, Mike Gatos, and more. And superstar artist David Lloyd has just become the newest creator to join the Cadence Comic Art family of artists. Cadence Comic Art makes buying original comic art fast and easy. They ship worldwide and have fantastic customer service. Check out their brand new site for a full list of artists and see for yourself how easy it can be to start your own original art collection at CadenceComicArt.com. That's www.cadencecomicart.com. And remember, if you're coming to the Windy City Comic Con, drop by the Cadence Comic Art booth.
Said goodbye to him, and in a rat and lucid state, she said, "My days are unoriginal."
Now, I know I talked to some people, designers and comic book folks, that kind of yearn for the old days, because there is a certain, you know, cathartic satisfaction with doing things, you know, in an old school way. That, I mean, there was, I feel this in design, and I know that some folks may feel this in comics, that the skill has maybe left the medium in some ways.
I don't buy that, because a computer is just another tool, and the software, the hardware is so sophisticated now. You can do anything and more that you could do by hand on the computer using Painter, Photoshop, you know, the new Wacom tablets. I just got a Cintiq tablet where I'm drawing right on the screen now.
You bastard.
You've been talking to Scott Johnson yet?
No. I mean, I'm on the line, but not in person. But yeah. I know he uses one too, and he does full digital paintings.
So Scott is kind of the Chicago Cintiq guru. I think every artist or colorist in Chicago that's gotten a Cintiq is like, Scott, can I come over to your house for a day?
Yeah, he does beautiful work. He does full digital paintings using that. And, you know, when we first started using computers, the software and hardware weren't quite there yet. You know, it was just getting going. As a matter of fact, when they really first started using, what Steve Wolf was using on Akira was a vector-based system, which was almost like trying to color with Illustrator. I know I'm getting technical now.
Yeah.
But
very, very flat shape.
Yeah, but it's you can do simple gradients, things like that. And now you can
Not really continuous tone, right, like photographs, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We've completely lost Tom.
I'm sort of understanding what's good. I understood gradient and the thing with tape. I get it. I understand it.
I mean, we can do so much more now, and I work pretty closely with the artists I work with. As a matter of fact, the new Fantastic Four stuff I'm doing with Dale Eaglesham, he's doing it just pencils. I'm coloring it straight from his pencils. And it's an interesting experiment, because there's certain things he really wants it to look like. You know, some artists, when we work from pencils, they want it to have a lot of that light pencil feel to it. Some guys want it to look inked, you know. Dale's a very classical guy, so we're working straight from pencils. He's penciling really tightly.
Mm-hmm.
we're trying to make it look almost ink, but still give it a little more of an organic feel and a painted feel and things like that. So.
Gene Ha's been doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
The Eisner award-winning issue that he did for JLA, was that two Eisners ago, I guess?
I think so, yeah.
Was seeing Gene's stuff basically, you know, straight from pencils. And I like that look. You know, I don't know if I want it in all my comics, but it's really nice.
You have to work pretty closely, you know, unless the artist is doing it himself, you have to work pretty closely with the penciler. Like Dave McCaig with Linnell Francis Yu does it very well. Some of those covers on, the Hulk Wolverine stuff is just beautiful because they work really closely together. And then there's some books that come out where the pencils just get lost, you know, it just turns gray and the whole thing just looks really muddy because the pencils weren't handled right and scanned right.
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of, just like we have penciler inker teams, there seem to be more and more penciler colorist teams now. It's like, I can't imagine Steve McNiven without Maury Hallowell.
Yeah.
You know, it's that they're a team. And it sounds like you're that way with Hitch on a lot of stuff now.
Yeah, Hitch, Waringo, I colored almost everything Waringo did while he was the last 10 years of his life, probably. Amanda Connor, I think I've colored pretty much everything Amanda Connor has done.
Are you doing Wednesday Comics?
Wednesday Comics and Power Girl, yeah.
That's a real. Have you seen this, Tony?
I'm crying.
Tony's crying because he wants to be part of that so badly.
No, I'm crying because you always say no to me, man.
No. Power Girl looks awesome.
Beautiful
the
coloring
art and everything
on that. Beautiful coloring on it. And that's an interesting one. Kind of talking about the old to the new is that now we have a new comic that is printed on paper that they really haven't printed comics on,
yeah.
You know, except in the newspapers for a long time. And I've talked about this on 11 o'clock a little bit, that the reason it's working, and I think the reason a lot of people are liking this, is that it has an old feel, but you're dealing with modern coloring and modern printing techniques.
I mean, you look at the Commandy pages, and it's like, mind-blowing.
Commandy never looked that good.
Yeah. it's definitely been a challenge, though, because you don't know. I mean, we didn't know what kind of paper was going to be printed on when we started working on this stuff.
Wow,
and
really?
Some of the books, like you look at like the Wonder Woman and Teen Titans stuff, you can tell that it's not quite working with the paper as well as it could.
Almost too muted.
And we're all adjusting it as we go along once we've seen the printed stuff. Now, I haven't seen the new one. We did this Aquaman.
Supergirl,
the new one. And I haven't seen how it printed yet. I'm a little worried because...
Number four?
Yeah, six.
Six.
The one that just came out this week.
Five or six came out this week.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we did all these like kind of sunset scenes with these twilight skies and everything. And I did it before we saw what kind of paper it was going to be on. And I'm really worried about how dark it's going to print out. So.
I didn't notice anything too weird. But I mean, thinking about printing on newsprint and looking at the Commandy pages, like that's insane to think about printing something like that where you can see all the sort of dark tones and everything in there is actually shows up on newsprint, which is we're gonna look at his face now.
As I find the script,
you're gonna hear it say, "God damn it,
son of a bitch!" I'm weeping.
I look at my work and I weep.
Mark Chiarello has been trying to get DC to do this for several years. Oh, it actually printed really nicely. Well, it looks good.
Yeah, I thought it looked nice, and I loved Aquaman in it too. I thought it was
Aquaman, and this is actually based on Dennis Leary. Aquaman is Dennis Leary in this. That's the dirty little secret. Jimmy and Amanda really wanted to do a different kind of.
I could definitely see that
of Aquaman. So he's Dennis Leary.
I think Jimmy's a big Rescue Me fan.
Yeah. Yeah, so yes, he is.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
But yeah, Chiarello tried to get this off the ground for like 2 years, 2-3 years, I think at least.
Volume two.
We'll see. they're still trying to
figure out. Tony's like, please.
I know, Tony's. They're still trying to figure out what format this is going to be reprinted in because, you know, they want to make a trade or a hardcover or something, and it's going to be a challenge because of the format that it's in now.
I'm like, I don't want to call this a vanity project, but it is what it is. It's just this amazing thing, and I want to see them just go over the top. On the collection, make it hardcover, big.
Well, that's what she would like. Yeah,
perfect, perfect. I'll drop $150 bucks on it and love it. And
yeah, this is his baby, and it's funny because he's juggling 45 different writers and artists on this, every week trying to get this out. I can't even imagine. He's just going to collapse by the time it's done. We only have two more to do. We just
You're number, on 10?
We just finished 10, yeah. Nice. So we just have 11 and 12 now to do.
Well, you guys are there. You're done.
Yeah.
You're good.
When you think that 6 just came out and it's coming out weekly, the fact that we just finished 10, it's kind of pretty close.
No, it's blown me away. I look forward to it every week, and I love the 12-week window that we have to do it. And it's like, man, I know that it's like guys like Tony. It's what okay. What do you want to do? If you could pick something, what do you want to do?
If I could pick something,
you just drew all those apes and Jack of Fables. Yeah, maybe you do a Gorilla City comic.
Yeah, I would do a Gorilla City comic. Yeah, I'm ready to do more apes. Boy, you know, I always like I bitch about the Superman stuff. I do a soup story, you know. I wouldn't do a Batman story for this. Like anybody would ever fucking ask me. But
there's going to be tons of artists begging to be on the next.
God. Yeah, I found out about this from Andrew Peepoy just as the last story got assigned. And, you know, I knew it was going to be huge.
I think it's something.
I think I even said it on this show. This is going to be effing huge.
Oh, well. And
it's not going to be a vanity project. It's going to be a Schiffer robe.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a way for DC to really explore some of their lesser known characters. It's like Commandy. Commandy is kind of the breakout hit of this. Ryan Sook is just drawing the crap out of that, and I think it's a way to do maybe some like Forever People. Would be fun. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before.
I love the Metal Men one too. The Flash one and the Metal Men one.
I would have killed the Color of the Metal Men stuff. Kevin Nolan and Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. I do a lot of licensing artwork for DC, and Ryan Sook and Garcia Lopez draw a lot of that stuff, all the toy packaging, all the stuff for licensing. And these drawings are just beautiful when I get them in to do the color on them.
I was going
to
say, you and Scott Johnson must have like...
he does all the Marvel stuff.
He does all the Marvel stuff. Yeah. You guys have little competitions. My Superman kicks your Spider-Man's ass.
Garcia Lopez has been doing it for a long time, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's... When I kind of think about Superman, his is actually the Superman that I think of in my head.
Mm-hmm.
When
not
I
think Kurt about, Swan?
No, not the... The Kurt Swan one was always too... I always associate the Kurt Swan one... I always associate the Kurt Swan one with, like, dealing out life lessons. Or, like, you know, like, God,
They finally just reprinted that Kurt Swan Murphy Anderson run that Denny O'Neill wrote in 71.
Oh, and that hardcover, yeah.
Have you read that stuff?
I've read where Julie Schwartz switched, they tried to get rid of kryptonite and, like,
Read that run. That run was 30 years ahead of its time.
Yeah, I always think it's funny with Superman because people are always like, oh, like, the... Like, the division line is the John Byrne reboot. And I'm like, well, there's been a lot of attempts up until that to change Superman. It's a very slow, gradual process.
And as soon as Denny O'Neill left, it went back to, like, the Mort Weisinger Superman stuff pretty much. Yeah, it was powerful again. But that 11 or 12 issues was
different.
Yeah, it was like somebody doing what all these guys in the 80s were doing 15 years earlier. And it was just amazing.
They weakened Superman. They tried to get rid of kryptonite. They had, like, it was...
Yeah, they took away half his powers. They got rid of kryptonite. The whole magic thing, all the super horse, all that stuff. They just wiped the slate clean and started over pretty much.
They went for it because Schwartz didn't want the Superman titles because he didn't like doing Superman stories. It was like he sort of got handed it to him because he liked doing sci-fi stories. And at that point, Superman was all it was the Weisinger.
Right.
It was like I'm when Superman spends his entire issue. Creating a convoluted situation to teach Lois Lane a lesson about, like, you should keep your mouth shut, you know?
Or,
like,
nice.
Stop being so nosy, you know?
Women like, that's shouldn't all he did drive.
That's all he did with his time was, like, do that. So it was a huge 180. And it's come out in those DC library
Chronicles?
Classics.
Right.
It's those hardcovers. Like, they had a Legion one come out with the Death of Pharaoh Lad, and they just had a Flash of Two Worlds one come out. It's a hardcover that collects, like, 12... The like 15 issues of one.
But when did you see DC in 1971 doing, you know, a 11 or 12 issue long storyline that like revamped a character? And Superman had brain damage in it at one point, and they had to like do brain surgery on him because he was like, you know, arresting criminal, you know, if a guy, we had a traffic violation, the guy, he would take the car and put it on top of the Empire State Building because he had brain damage.
Went all Punisher on him.
Yeah, really.
I don't think it was that terribly popular at the time. I think it kind of switched back, and then they went back to it.
As I said, it was way ahead of its time. If they had done it 10 years later, it would have been
fine.
Yeah. Because
Then they kind of went back to the Weisinger stuff a little bit, and then, like, Wolfman did a bunch of stuff in the early 80s that kind of updated it a little bit.
We've entered a huge rat hole, haven't we?
No, man, that's why we're here.
This is what I talk about.
You're in a comic shop on a Friday night talking about comics.
I could be home watching the Neil Diamond special on NBC, but no, I'm here.
That's on?
Tony, come back.
Do you know how sad it is? Is that I was already thinking about the John Byrne reboot of Superman earlier today.
It was good.
No, it was good. I think...
They've actually kept a lot of it and the stuff that they're doing.
I like
doing
what
with
Byrne
that.
Did on Superman, yeah.
Yeah, I do too. It bothers me, though, first time
I ever read Superman.
It does bother me, though, when people are like, anything before Byrne is Silver Age. There's a lot of guys that did a lot of stuff like in the late 70s, early 80s that switched things up and changed it. So, you know,
That's how you know when you're getting old, because when I was a kid, Silver Age was, you know, the Flash reboot up until about, like, the Marvel Age. And the Marvel Age started in 61. Yeah. Silver Age was only about 5 years.
Now, you know what? Now people say the Silver Age is, like, pretty much anything before they started reading.
Right.
I've heard it goes
up to when Gwen Stacy dies. I've heard it goes up to, you know, the Superman.
People are like, Superman's back to the Silver Age. I'm like, until I see Superman walking around with a lion's head in an issue. I'm sorry, that was a great story.
Yeah. Don't pick on that.
I know, but I'm just saying. Listen, until that happens. Trust me, this is not a Silver Age Superman.
Tom does a podcast 3 days a week that does blow by blow recaps of Silver Age Flash issues. He does it as a podcast called Tom versus the Flash. So you're talking to a man who holds the Silver Age up with a lot of reverence.
That's why it offends my sensibilities when they're like, that Silver Age stuff. It's like, Wolfman didn't write a Silver Age story in 1981.
What offends you, which I've picked up on this, is that when people say, well, this character did this in the Silver Age, and you're like, no, they didn't.
No. Everyone spent all their time in the Silver Age teaching their friends lessons.
So when did Silver Age end? When does it run from what to what?
I would say from...
You're wrong.
I would say from, like, Showcase number 4, probably, which is, like, 56.
Yeah. I would say that's
usually the start, right?
Yeah, I'd say by mid-60s, it's kind of
okay,
over.
See, that's what I think, too, but everybody else seems to think it runs a lot
longer. I actually think
that
the Martian Manhunter was the beginning of this.
No, because he was just a detective all the time.
So did you like New Frontier, the Darwin Cook stuff?
I did like New Frontier a lot.
Oh, hell yeah.
I was going to mention that with the... it sounds a lot like the story of trying to get New Frontier done, same as with Wednesday's Comics, where they kind of had to beg to get New Frontier.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it took a really long time to convince DC to do New Frontier.
But Darwin is a force of nature, man. That guy, when he wants to get something done, he'll get it done.
Oh, dude. He's the very first person to ever do an adaptation of a Richard Stark novel with the Parker character and actually use the name Parker.
Yeah,
he's fucking relentless.
In the movie in Payback, it's Porter. That was the thing that it's not Richard Stark. Real name. Help me out real quick.
I don't know.
Richard Stark's real name.
Doesn't matter.
Tony Stark.
No.
Sorry,
Richard Dawson.
It's been a long time.
I don't know.
Delbert Manis.
Everybody knows who you're talking about.
Okay, wait, while he's going to get it, what's the verdict on the Mike Mignola Superman? All right,
Donald Westlake.
He did that Cosmic Odyssey stuff with.
Look how fast this book sold out. This book sold out. Like, nobody can get a copy of it now. I can't believe you have a copy.
What's it going for on eBay? I'll buy that right now. But New Frontier is my favorite comic book of all time.
You know what?
And you talk about coloring Dave Stewart on that book.
Yeah.
I mean, I emailed him when that came out. It's like, man, you got the lock on the Eisner this year. There's nobody who even comes close to
what
he did.
Did he win the Eisner that year?
I think so.
Yeah, he did. Because I congratulated him as he was coming out of the.
Yeah. He won it this year, too.
God damn. I mean, that is.
Okay. What colors do you hate?
I'll tell you, we had a conversation about this. I was going to say Tony knows this, so I'm not even going near
this. What we mean by hate, we mean every because single person so that we know that this comes from Mike Norton.
Awesome.
Because Mike Norton, yeah. Because Mike Norton, the pencilers he hates are the ones that are really good. He resents like looking at their stuff. Like,
yeah.
Now, who are the guys that you open a book and are just like, oh, son of a bitch. God, that's good.
You know, there are so many good colorists working right now. I mean, we talk about Dave Stewart. And Dave Stewart, especially when he's paired with the right people. I've seen him on books where he's not with the right artist and it doesn't work. But like with Darwin or some of the other stuff.
Any of the Mignola stuff.
Phenomenal. Yeah, the Mignola stuff. Any of that stuff.
Have you seen his Detective Comics stuff?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just gorgeous. And on that same tack, the backups in Detective Comics. You know,
with Cully?
Yeah. With Cully Hamner and Laura Martin, who just signed an exclusive with Marvel, so she's not going to do those anymore, but Dave McCaig's taking those over.
Well, hey.
And Dave McCaig will be perfect on Cully Hamner. Dave McCaig's doing beautiful work. And we all sit around, pat each other on the back on the Gutter Zombie message boards, which is the comic colorist message board area. So.
The whole, that's a great site and a great forum. If you ever have any questions or you're an aspiring colorist, but are colorists, is there kind of a fraternity? Do you guys all kind of get along and,
share tools
of the trade?
Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, I got to tell you, comics for a mass media, for a pop culture mass media kind of thing, there's a lot of really good people in comics. You know, it's not like, Tony and I both worked in advertising before we got into comics.
A lot of dicks.
You know, we'd see art directors who were, you know, 35 years old who were in the bars at 9:30 in the morning. Yeah. Who looked like they were 50 and had been worn down by pencil notes.
It's dog eat dog.
You know, Jimmy Palmiotti, a good friend of mine, he does so much work in Hollywood, and it's just so frustrating sometimes. As a matter of fact, the book we did with Garth Ennis, The Pro, it was Garth Ennis, Jimmy, and Amanda and me. They're developing for a TV series, I can't say where, but I mean, it's been like a year and they're just arguing over voice talent. And, you know, you spend so much time with people who, you know, don't really get the properties, you don't know if you're going to deal with them in a good way.
Isn't that kind of what makes comics kind of fun?
It's so simple to get. Yeah. I mean, there's not as much money in comics, but I got to tell you, you do the job, it gets out there. There's a much more direct line between the creator and the consumer. And for the most part, and even like editors at Marvel and DC, I've worked with a bunch of really good people. Most of the comic colorists that I know are really good guys. Tony's a jerk, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody knows that about Tony.
There's not a ton of arguing.
Word of the week, I think of heinous when I think
there's
of
not a ton of there's not a ton of arguing about like stapling the issues and like what I don't think this staple is gonna market well.
is this fucking nickel on my book?
You know,
is this nickel?
And it's something that you can hold.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you can pick it up.
And that's a beautiful. I'm always about the book. I'm always about the fetish of
but
the
right,
book.
But this is one of the discussions happening now too, because what's going to happen if Apple brings out say this tablet in the next month or two? That's imagine. A Kindle-like device.
Is it a tablet
that's made by
headaches?
Apple that's full color, that's like 10 inches?
Well,
you talk about digital comics and stuff taking off. That could be a game changer for digital books, ebooks, comics, and things like that.
Yeah, I still think at some point.
People are always going to like paper.
I think at some point, if people really like something, they'll still buy.
Yeah. I mean, sure.
Like
because,
I'm not saying it'll be the only thing, but you look at like Europe and Japan. I mean, mobile phone comics are huge.
Yeah.
It's a huge, it's
their
huge
phones
thing.
Are way better too.
And I know that Marvel and DC and all these publishers now are working towards, you know, you can do a comic that'll work digitally and can be reprinted. Like the Neil Adams has been working on the webcomic stuff, the motion comic stuff for X-Men. And that's going to be released as a DVD. And, you know, they're thinking about all this stuff way ahead of time. So
his X-Men stuff with Roy Thomas?
No. He's Continuity Studios is actually, they're doing the animation for a bunch of new X-Men stuff that is based
I just want the stuff with Roy Thomas.
This stuff is really, I mean, he's really taking it in a whole new direction. I think they showed some of it at San Diego, actually. But,
I haven't been impressed by the motion comics so far.
The Watchmen one was very good.
Neil's doing a bunch of new, they're using a whole bunch of new technology where they're actually image mapping the artist's style onto 3D models and everything as they're doing motion capture and everything on it. And it's, from what I've heard, it's just phenomenal.
It's going to be interesting. I didn't like the Watchmen one that much.
I did.
I kind of just felt like I should just read it.
Well, see, that's the thing. I'm not a huge fan of the multimedia motion comics and everything so far. So I'm really anxious because I was talking to Neil about what they were doing on it. And they're taking a whole different tact than what's been shown so far. So.
Yeah. Hmm. Because all the ones I've seen so far, I've just been like, oh, well, I mean, I'll just
Read it.
Yeah.
Because yeah. it's, like, it's not quite a book and it's not quite a cartoon.
It's a novelty. It's a novelty. Yeah. It's a novelty. Yeah.
It is.
This portion of Around Comics is brought to you by Netflix. Right now, you can start a free 2-week trial by going to www.netflix.com/Around Comics. And at Netflix, you'll find over 100,000 titles to choose from, including classics and new releases, as well as TV series. Plans start from as low as $4.99 per month, and you can keep each movie as long as you want with no late fees ever. Netflix has free shipping both ways, and you can expect your next selection to be delivered in about one business day. Now watch some movies and TV series over the internet for no extra charge. I use this service with my Xbox 360 and personal laptop and love it. So head over to www.netflix.com/Around Comics and get started with your free trial today. Now, how did you guys meet? I'm pointing at Tony and Paul.
How did Tony
was
and I
in a dark alley one day.
Yes. Yeah, I was looking for some rough trade and
what? And
this is,
and I had a scuffed up trade paperback and
we met 1986.
84, fall,
the year that
fall,
everything
fall
changed.
Of 84.
Yeah, 84.
We were doing storyboards. We worked at a company doing storyboards for TV commercials downtown Chicago.
Yeah, and storyboards for TV commercials, also animatics, going back to the whole animated comic thing. I mean, what we were doing then is very much akin to what you see like on the Hellboy DVD where there's the animated comic.
Except we were all doing it by hand and cutting out little eyeballs to move and things like that. Yeah. Now it's all done digitally.
Yeah,
of course,
but. Yeah. So, yeah, that's where we met. And there were also other artists in the studio. And this is like the first time I had ever been thrown in to a group of artists. I had always pretty much been on my own before, mm-hmm. or just completely out of the art world. But this is the first time where I was around, you know, guys who were professionals. And they all were reading comics at the time. I hadn't read... picked up a comic book since probably 79. And Paul, I remember, brought by a stack that included Hernandez
Archie.
Brothers. Oh. No, it was the Hernandez Brothers. It was Love and Rockets.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And
you think about 84, 85, that's when Love and Rockets came out. You know, you had Cerebus really hitting its stride. You had Watchmen. You had Dark Knight. I mean, that was the year for comics.
Yeah. Also, there was some Dark Horse stuff in there. Yeah. And Dark Horse is just doing black and white at that time. They hadn't...
Horse the Bear.
Yeah. So, you know.
TMNT was probably just
starting,
getting ready to start.
Exactly. And that's... Paul is actually the person who got me into comics. Because
wow,
yeah.
So he's the one that you blame.
Actually, yeah. This is the guy. This is the guy right here.
It's his fault.
It's totally his fault that I'm working in this industry because I had quit the studio and moved to Washington D.C. Paul had, I don't know if you had quit the studio, but you were also working at Now.
Now and First. Yeah, I left the studio by that point. Yeah.
And you called me from Chicago, and I'm in Washington D.C. doing advertising, doing storyboards. And Paul asked if I wanted to draw a book. Actually, you made me draw my first page of continuity.
Was that Rust?
No, it was like some superhero guy in an alley. I found it, but Paul actually forced me to do my first page of continuity.
So, Neil's studio?
No. Instead of just pinning up some covers and stuff. Because
exactly.
Even just doing storyboards.
Yeah.
It was his first page of comics.
Continuity. And so based on that.
Sequential.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, based on that abortion.
Because I was working at Now Comics. I was like the art director. Technically. Yeah. I was Signet Ash, the art director at
That's
Now
right.
Comics.
That's right. And so I get a call and he says, you know, what are you doing? You want to, you know, do a book? And I think it was Eben.
I think
it was Evan, which was like this. I still don't know what the hell that was. It was like a Vietnam.
It was a raven who was a Western. It was a Western starring a raven as a cowboy.
And then we tried
to... 6-foot raven.
Yeah, it was weird.
And this was at First?
No, this was Now Comics.
Yeah. Now, okay. Yeah.
And then we tried... Didn't we try to get on the whole Ginsu Groundhog... You know,
oh, yeah, we did one of those. Teenage Ginsu Groundhog, something like that. Yeah. Because there was a million parodies like
there
that.
There were a million parodies. Yeah. So, but the first thing that really clicked was you, myself, Fred Schiller on Rust at Now Comics, which, you know,
was again one of those books that was way ahead of its time. Well, and yeah. Failed miserably.
That whole time, Chicago and Madison to a certain extent, but the Midwest, I mean, comics had been dominated by New York, and there was like this sudden, you know, upcrop of comic book companies in the Midwest and in really Chicago. You had First and Now.
Kimiko
was here.
What was, you know, I read those comics. I grew up in Southern Illinois. I had no idea they were from Chicago or the upper Midwest, whatever. What was that like with the whole comic book community popping up here in Chicago and kind of, you know, what was going on?
It seemed really natural, and it was, you know, certainly it was new to me because I was new to it, but I'm still surprised by just the number of creators that are still here in the city.
Yeah, when you think of it, we had Hillary Barta and Jill Thompson, of course, and Alex Wald was the art director at first.
When Wald was directing at first, I remember walking in to the office on LaSalle Street for the first time, and he's pulling something out of it's a painting, and he's leaning it up against the wall, and everyone in the office is coming out to look at this painting because it's a cover painting, an actual oil painting for
full-size, like, actual painting for...
For a cover of Nexus that Steve Rude just made down. I mean, you could smell, you know, the linseed oil coming off of this. I mean, it was a different thing. It was a different...
And, of course, Now Comics gave Alex Ross's... He was the Terminator book. That was Alex Ross's first work in comics. Yeah. It was the Terminator.
Alex Wald actually is kind of responsible for us getting Jeff Darrow at the Windy City.
That's crazy!
Because Alex introduced, kind of walked me over to Jeff's table this a couple weekends ago and said, hey, Jeff, you should do their show.
In San Diego?
No.
Chicago
Comic Con. Okay. So Alex has been a guest at the show last year, but you forget he was the art director. For First, right?
Yeah. Just huge influence on me because I was, you know, you certainly didn't give me any sort of.
you were no influence to me.
You just pushed him into it.
I hired him and walked away.
Yeah, he pushed me in front of the bus. Uh-huh. But Alex is, you know, a real guru for me at first because, he said, you know, this is, you know, there's this no set number of lines that it takes to make an eye. An eye is, you know, it's not.
I just pulled out some Badger issues, some Capital City ones and then some First ones.
Yeah.
And I just bought the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles collected edition.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah. They just reprinted like the first 11 issues plus like which have been impossible to find.
The Fugitoid miniseries or the one shot.
The one shot
in there as well.
Which is really funny when you think of stuff like that. Like
I still have that Fugitoid issue at home.
They're reprinting a lot of that stuff though, the Mike Grell single stuff. They're reprinting that.
Now to get back to that.
And that's what it was about us. You know, about the Midwest.
Well,
I mean,
who was in that crew? I mean, you guys had a real group.
Well, at Now, it was certainly Paul and I and Fred Schiller. We were, you know, I mean, we were.
Rob Davis was drawing Dai Kamikaze. Yeah. But he's from Kansas City. He wasn't really a Chicago guy, but he was working for Now.
But what it was like New York had become ossified. Basically, you know, this is 1986 and all the new stuff, you know, I thought that was new and unconventional were, you know, obviously stuff coming from wherever Dark Horse was at the time, Milwaukee, Oregon. And then
then you had West Coast stuff like the Hernandez brothers and Peter Baggy. They were starting out in the West Coast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think that we ran because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And you just prodded me on. I mean, we did a cover. there's a cover that because I was so late on it, the cover for the issue is basically Paul's explanation of why there's no cover. This is a typewritten page.
It was just
a
typewritten page that we used as the cover, It was like the description. It was Fred's description of the cover, I think. It was the description of the cover that he sent to you.
You know, and
we love Tony.
That's awesome.
But, you know, we did made some really organic choices that just kind of helped set the book apart from the pack, which I think was what was important at the time because... the pack that existed, you know.
And a lot of the people who are involved in now, especially, they're not working in comics anymore. So it's, no. you know, the crew has been very fluid over the years. I mean, yeah. Tony has been instrumental in putting together these comic luncheons that a lot of the creators that are here in Chicago now go to. Like, used to be once a month. It's been slacking lately.
One of the things that always really impressed me, like in rereading the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles stuff and reading like old Badger issues and stuff like that, is they don't. Like, if you pick up, like, a Marvel or a DC comic, there's a tone to it that you kind of know going into it, which isn't bad or good. I mean, that's just how it works. But you kind of pick up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or The Badger, and it's kind of parody but serious but also sort of... it's like a weird mix where you don't quite know what it's supposed to be.
It was cable TV to network.
It really was. And there was... I mean, one of the things I loved about Rust, I think Rust is something that we'll never... You know, never be reprinted. Nobody ever really saw it, but you know, we could do anything we wanted with it, and it had this great energy to it because of that, and this experimentation that you could never get away with at a lot of
there's
places
sort of
today.
Like,
and First, and now really Foster led
Dreadstar.
Like,
weird effective clumsiness to it, like, but not like in a bad way, but sort of like
again,
the way
left-handed compliment show. Right?
So all that stuff, there, but not in a bad way. Like in the same way that if someone really knows how to do something, sometimes they get really rigid into doing it a certain way.
Yeah.
And when someone's trying to learn how to do something, they kind of, it's like when you read some of that stuff, it's really good, but it's sort of like a weird backing into something good and figuring out that it's good and not quite knowing what's the quote unquote right way.
Yeah. And some of those books were definitely rough. They were absolutely rough, but you know, when they worked, they really worked.
Lock and Key. I'm really enjoying, and we were talking about, who's it? Juan Hill. No.
Oh, it's, Joe Hill.
Joe Hill.
Joe Hill, who is Stephen King's real wife's son.
Okay.
And then
Gabriel Rodriguez
on art and Jay Photos on colors.
Yeah. Okay. Now that's the Rodriguez is new to comics. I would assume. I've never seen his work before.
Yeah.
But it's fresh and sort of that backing into it that it's solid work. Very illustrative, more so than comic.
It's
terrific.
Yeah. It's different than other stuff. Yeah. You look at it and it's like, wow. Yeah, there's a crispness to it.
So
it's always funny. It's always good when you read the first issue of something, like, and you're like, what the fuck is this? Like, I don't get what this is supposed to be. You know, like, I don't understand what this is. It's entertaining, but I don't know what this is supposed to be. Like, was it supposed to be a parody? Was it supposed to be serious? And then as you see, it goes along, you know. One of my favorite Badger issues, I didn't get into the Badger until I was a little bit older, but...
There's a line that you shouldn't speak in public too much. I didn't get into the Badger till I was a little bit older.
Yeah, until I was a little bit older.
Don't say that on the bus or anything.
People won't get
it from you.
What are you into? There's an issue that takes... Well, it was in Madison, and I went to college in Madison.
Right.
So,
what kind of beer did Badger drink? Point.
Point's good beer, man.
It's fully Croizened.
Fully Croizened. You could get it at Vos Formos near my house. But there's the Phantom of Bascom Hill, which is like... I was like, oh yeah, there's like tunnels underneath Bascom Hill, but it was always stuff like that, and you can never quite pin down what any of those books were really supposed to be,
right.
Which I appreciate now when I was older, but I assume at the time people were like, I don't understand what this is. What's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles supposed is like? Is it supposed to be funny? Because it's not. Really funny,
what's great about that book is that it was like an almost immediate homage to what Frank Miller was doing, Daredevil.
And like mixed together, and it's a parody but not really funny and entertaining entirely on its own, so it's
but it worked for them.
Yeah, it worked incredibly. You read the first one.
Those guys did okay.
Yeah. No, I mean it worked really well because you read the first one, you're like, oh, I kind of because that first issue is a story in and of itself that needs no continuation, but you get to the end, you're like, I kind of want to see what else happens with it, you know. So,
you know,
and then you see them sort of work their way along as you read that collection. You're like, and they kind of figure, you know,
build this world.
Yeah, and yeah. It's awesome.
Well,
it's
you incredible. Know, Tom and I were, you know, comic fans. You young comic fans. You guys were kind of coming up into the industry.
Yeah.
What did you think of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when it came out? Oh, and then it exploded.
At the time, I thought these things happen. This is, you know, I'm trying, you know, Paul was in comics. He followed comics. I left comics. And so all of this for me then was just like, okay, this is, you know, this is the trend. I always look at trends. Mm-hmm, and sure. It's so trends come, trends go. You know, I was never, again, big into the whole superhero thing. But what I was most impressed with was stuff that was coming out of first publishing, not so much, mm-hmm. you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But, you know, that horse had left the barn. And,
yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not going to be interested in reading it. But what's, you know, what am I going to look at that is, you know, something that is going to, you know, reach me, make me, convince me to continue working in comics. And the first thing that's hit me in the face was The Watchmen, you know. So things like The Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns, God, what else? Oh, of course, Nexus were the things that just kind of like.
I'm really glad they start putting out those tiny, the digest size uh-huh. Nexus uh-huh. reprints.
Yeah, I hope they keep coming out with them.
Yeah,
I hope so.
We'll see. Steve Root is pretty much retired from comics now. I don't know if you've ever gotten his newsletters recently, but
yeah, he's kind
of he's got the last couple issues of Nexus out, and financially he's just not palatable for him. And, you know, he's not the kind of guy who's going to work for mainstream publishers right now.
No,
so
no.
I've worked with him on a few projects. I worked with him on what was that X-Men book he did? I forget. It was kind of like the origin of the X-Men. It was like, you know, it took place in the 60s. And
yeah.
It was a very drawn classic.
I just broke out a Miracle Man one-shot that he drew.
Oh, that was beautiful, wasn't
wow.
it? Yeah, that was the one Mark Evanier
wrote. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark Evanier wrote it.
Crazy. I didn't even know that. There were things I didn't even know exist. I had no idea.
Those Nexus,
I can't believe that, Tony.
But those
there's things you don't
those
know.
Those really Nexus issues are so good and so far ahead.
Oh, God. You see Nexus 68, 69? Phenomenal. Oh, I drew that.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tony drew Nexus for a while, so.
Yeah, but
I still can't believe you
don't need to get that far into
it. No, you really don't.
Well, what's it like following up on a series where a guy like Steve Rude,
man,
he's shaking his head.
You cried when you saw
him. you can't imagine. I don't know how I did that. I do, first off, what were the circumstances where I was asked to replace Steve Rude on this book, you know, for two issues, you know, and I did it and I forgot about it. And that's the only way I know I can, that's the only way I deal with it now is the fact that I don't think about it. I don't think of having to follow that man in any way whatsoever. In at the time, you know, I sweated it out.
Because
there's a few days where you're good.
I mean, you're very good, Tony.
Thank you.
I mean, you're a very good artist. Following Steve Rude, I mean, that's kind of crazy.
Because he's got such like a loose style leaves a lot of room for you to really come in and, you know, get something done.
Yeah, well, you know, it was cool. I was happy to do it. And, you know, obviously it was great getting paid to, it's always great getting paid to draw comics.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
So, yeah. Shiny moment. I was crying my tears in my habitat.
Both have worked with people that you absolutely idolize in the industry. Do you kind of go that, oh shit, I just got an email from Brian Boland, or, you know, is it weird?
This
or?
Week, as a matter of fact, I was working on a book for Marvel that Tom Palmer was inking. Now, Tom Palmer, this guy, you know, he had been in comics 15 years, 20 years when I was a kid.
I pulled out a old issue of Phantom Stranger that Tom Palmer inked, and I was like, oh shit, this book's from like 1970.
Well, he was, yeah, I mean, yeah. He was, yeah, he was thinking, you know, the Neil Adams stuff,
yeah,
the Gene Colan Time and Tomb of Dracula in the 60s and 70s and all that stuff. And
I forgot how long he'd been around. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
shit.
He's been in since the 60s. And so he calls me on the phone, and suddenly it's like I see on the call already Tom Palmer's calling me because he's got to get this page to me. We're rushing a deadline. He has to like scan it and gives me, needs my email. He wants to talk to me about formatting and everything. We end up being on the phone for like 2 hours, and he's telling me these incredible stories about, like, he used to work with the model who posed for Doc Savage for James Bama, doing all those paperback covers, and these just amazing stories about the photographer and the model and how they would do these covers and things like that. And it's like, I'm talking to Tom Palmer. You know, it's like
crazy.
You know, nicest, greatest guy in the world. But yeah, I mean, every once in a while you do that. I mean, I've worked with Steranko and Neil Adams and, you know, Brian Hitch and, you know, just all these people that, you know, you're just fans of, and then all of a sudden you're talking to them on the phone, and it's, it's very surreal.
Yeah. As a contemporary.
And then you realize they're all nuts, so it's okay.
I was going to say, the complete opposite of that, complete 180 from that Tom Palmer experience, is like, never get on the phone with Harlan Ellison.
Right, yeah.
Really? You've talked to Harlan Ellison?
Yeah, it was like some project that he was trying to get off the ground. I think it involved Art Spiegelman somehow. I have no idea. But yeah, I was on the phone I'm sure it was like maybe 40 minutes, but it felt like 2 hours. And it's like in my conversation was basically this. It was like, Harlan. Yeah, Harlan.
I have to go to the bathroom. Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah.
Watch what you say. You might get sued.
Well, you know,
come and get me.
Come and get me, Harlan Ellison.
No, but, you know, true talent, but. You know, it's like that the where the rubber meets the road when something's getting done. You know, it's all that back and forth that, you know, drives you crazy. Sometimes.
Yeah, you love the work. It's the getting the work done that, I mean, it's being in the work is, I mean, it's different than the final product.
Right,
so Harlan Ellison, amazing, you know, incredibly creative guy. But. Yeah, there are stories. It's maybe not the easiest person in the world to work with.
But you know what? That's what this business is like. You come across individuals who have a certain approach to the world in general about just, you know, whatever issues they have, and I respect that because I certainly have issues with how I work and. You know, it's how it is.
Yeah, I was just saying
the thing about Harlan Ellison too is, you know, he just cares so much about the work. The guy's just so passionate about what he does. You know, I do a lot of work with Jimmy Palmiotti, and there are colorists and artists that he works with who just don't even want to talk to him because, like, he'll send extensive notes, and he just sweats and obsesses over every panel. But it's just because he cares so much about the work and about making it right and about making it good. And
See, that's awesome. I there are reasons why I don't even bother doing that.
Oh, God. No, but there, I mean...
What?
No, I was going to say, there are... It's nice to see that passion from somebody who's been doing comics as long as, you know, Jimmy's been doing them, or for somebody who's writing as long as Harlan has, because you see a lot of people who, you know, they're excited when they get in, they've got that verve and energy, and then, you know, after a few years,
whatever,
they're
just Spider-Man.
Yeah, it's like, oh.
What's he doing?
When's it due? It's due Friday. Okay, yeah. And, you know,
he's swinging through the city. What else does he do?
Yeah.
What would you want him to do? Anything? Nah, just whatever. Nah, same old Spider-Man.
It's a web. It's a web. No, it's not a wire.
It's just a comic book. No, it's just a comic book.
It's not mucus. It's not mucus.
Stencil some women from a magazine. I don't know.
Well, I tell you, let's get ready to wrap this one up. Before we do, Tony, Jack Fables, still monthly.
Jack
still
of
awesome.
Fables, still monthly. Still flipping awesome. Just wait till I get back on the book. Funny. All those things. Russ Braun, the alternate artist, is doing a bang up job on issue 38 right now. I've been looking at the pencils; they're effing hilarious. And then I come back on the book with something that is just literally out of this world.
It is literally out of this world.
Nice. Basically, we expect no less from Jack.
Yeah,
I was going to say Sturgis getting a big head with all this JSA work.
You know what? Yeah, he is.
Mr. Kinda. Sturgis.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, he refers to himself in the third person as Mr. Sturgis.
My first name is now Mr.
Sturgis is going to make himself a sandwich now, Tony. Be best if you...
You just stay on the line. I'll be back in a few.
Mr. Sturgis will be back.
As long as it's not a Tony sandwich. The arc that I'm coming in on, issue 41, I'm taking it a little, actually quite a bit off of the reservation as far as editorial direction, which I think the story lends itself to, because it's sort of, it's kind of a Jack Carter Barsoom story. It's more sci-fi than fantasy.
And how are you going to get the chain link fence? In the sci-fi story,
it's a space fence.
It's a space fence. Yes, it's got gravity belts. And
we discovered
weird fence fetish.
Yeah, we discovered last time whenever Tony was here and we were talking to Matt that he has this weird fetish with chain link fence that crops up. He has a chain link fence that ends up in just about every script that he does. So.
Yeah, he does. He does. You know, and I'm cool with it now because I told you I was rifling through Watchmen and
I saw how
Gibbons solved that problem. Now I'm doodling Gibbons' chain link fences in the borders. Just nice. So like,
man,
remember.
Watchmen's got to have a ton of fucking chain link fences.
Yeah, they do. It's that first scene where Rorschach is visiting Dr. Manhattan and Manhattan teleports him outside the perimeter. It's that scene in the book. I'm like, that's awesome. That's beautiful.
You gotta go back and look at that.
That's beautiful.
That's over there. I'll grab it.
The great chain link fence problem that all artists face.
Yeah, it's real biatch. But yeah, Jack of Fables still rocking.
Awesome. You made it through the Great Fables crossover. Yeah. Everybody intact.
Yeah, yeah.
Matt didn't eat the bug.
No, Matt didn't have to eat the bug. But I'm eating the bug now because Jack in issue 41 is riding a large millipede. That's his steed. And
that sounds fun to draw.
Yeah. Well, you know what is kind of cool?
It's a great drawing. He showed me the pencil.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very phallic, though. It's so I'm yeah, it's very phallic.
Speaking of pages.
It fits Jack. It's very phallic. It's,
oh, yeah. Then it fits. speaking of original art, are you going to have any to sell at Windy City?
Yeah. Actually, Paul and I were talking about doing special prints for Windy City.
Yes.
Why, yes.
You asshole. You just
No, I'm ready to do it.
Have you seen my schedule?
Well, you guys want to sit together? Are
sure.
you free?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm okay, what's my status there?
You're good.
I'm good. Yeah. Okay. All right, cool.
You gotta share your
I wanted to come, but I went on the website and it says guest space is all full. If you want to be a guest, screw you. You don't want to space. We don't want you. Go away.
I had already talked with you back several months ago. So
totally share a table. No doubt. Okay. No doubt.
Right. What we've discovered about Tony is that when he goes to a convention, he does not stay at his table.
Yeah. No.
He wanders.
I like to wander.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's
boring
nuts.
Sitting at the table too.
It'll be like, Paul, I have to go to the bathroom. Can you watch the table for a minute? 3 hours later, he'll come back, and so that'll be it.
I found this at White Elephant across the street. It's a lamb. It's awesome.
So yes, you will have some original art there.
Original art plus we are doing a print. We talked about this the other night. We're doing something because it's
we better get on it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's like. It's like 40 days or 38 days, something like that.
I saw the countdown. There's a countdown clock on the site.
As we record this, it's probably closer to like 20 days as this episode comes out. All so, right. Well, Tony's easy because he works on like one book a month. Colorist, multiple books. What are you working on?
Fantastic Four, the Dale Eagles from Jonathan Hickman run, comes out very soon. The first issue comes out, I think, in a couple of weeks. So, there's been some of the preview art online, and people have been raving about it.
He's good.
Just phenomenal. And Power Girl, every month with Jimmy and Amanda.
Fun series.
And Justin Gray. Yeah. And let's see what else. I just started on Moon Knight, actually. Some really cool stuff on Moon Knight.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple more issues of Captain America Reborn. So.
So on the Fantastic Four thing, are you kind of like part of the package deal? It's when Dale and Jonathan came on, it's like okay, welcome to Fantastic Four. Paul will be your colorist.
It would really be nice to think that's the case. Yeah. I think I worked with Mike Waringo on it for a lot of years, and then Mike McCone came on and
you're like on the email template.
And you kind of right. And you kind of said, oh, I like Paul's stuff. Okay, that'll be good. And then when Hitch came on, you know, I had been working with Hitch, so that was just natural. Yeah. And then when Dale Eaglesham came on, I think Tom Brevoort just said, you know, do you want Paul to stay? I don't think it's like, you know, Paul's part of the deal.
It's like, this is Paul.
It's
a little secret in the internet. This is Paul's book.
Right, yeah. So, you know.
Not many people know this. You know. This is Paul's book.
He's going for a record.
Mr. Mounts chose you.
But, yeah, I mean, luckily Dale, like, you know, my stuff.
Cool.
It seems
that's
he likes my stuff anyway. So it's been going pretty well so far. I think the first issue looks really nice. So
awesome. I'm looking forward to it. I think I'm looking forward to the Hickman. I like the Fantastic Four, but I've had a hard time finding a Fantastic Four story to.
Hickman's script is incredible.
Somebody needs to blow that shit up and just get crazy with it. And I think Jonathan has that kind of mindset.
Yeah, I tell you, I only read the first two, but it's definitely Fantastic Four. It's not like he's just, you know, throwing this template out, but he's definitely brought it into, you know, the 2000s, the 21st century, and in a way where it's new and different. You know, you're not like, you know the characters, but you're not bored by what you're seeing because you've seen it a million times before.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because I like the Fantastic Four. So
it's a hard book to write.
It is. It's that's the problem. It's a really hard book to write.
Yeah.
And even when Mark Miller and Brian Hitch were doing it, you know, they had these amazing ideas and it never quite came across, I think, the way they wanted it to. Although, I think when it's collected, it's going to read great.
Yeah, I think we've talked about that with that book, is that I think it got off to a little bit of a slow start and then they kind of found their feet with it.
Right.
And I think that you're right. As it's collected, I think people will.
Collected, I think that run's going
to
run
great. I always think with me with the Fantastic Four, the key to it isn't that it's just a family arguing. It's like a family arguing in the negative zone. So, that's always the stuff that...
And the thing is, when Jack Kirby was doing that book, the whole thing was it was a book of ideas. It was new ideas. I mean, look at those first 50 issues. How many concepts were created in those first 50 issues of
Scrolls,
Fantastic Four?
Scrolls, Inhumans, the whole Galactus and Silver
and
Surfer.
So many people have done it since then, have just followed that same stuff because they want to be reverent to Stan and Jack and everything. And you really got to...
Well, it's like the boilerplate was made in the first 50 issues. Yeah.
Well,
or the first 100 issues and just redo
there, it got lost for a while, and then Byrne went back to that, and then after that no one was quite, I mean, there's been good stuff, like I really liked the Dwayne McDuffie stuff, actually I thought was very well written and really interesting to read, but then I don't think anyone's ever gotten like a hold of it and done like a good like 3-4 years where it's been like,
and Mark and Brian came close. They had a lot of great ideas, but like you say, it'll read better collected than as a monthly. I think the Hickman stuff is going to work as a monthly from what I've seen of it so far.
Yeah,
so it's gonna be cool. Awesome. Yeah. Forward to it.
All awesome. Right. Well, great. All right. Well, thanks, guys. We already talked about Windy City Comic Con last week. We announced Jeff Darrow and
Moritat.
It's a huge list. It's 80 plus creators.
Get there early. There's just like 500 creators. There's going to be room for 12 people.
Yeah, it's going to be the most. It's going to be the most exclusive show you've ever gone to. It's going to be an amazing time. The event, the full event schedule is up. We've got an inkers panel. It's called the Inkwell of Knowledge. We've got a writers panel with B. Clay Moore and Will Pfeiffer, and oh gosh, I'm going to forget the other writer on that panel. But a great writer's panel.
Oh, Alan Moore.
Yes, Alan Moore.
And Harlan Ellison.
Yeah.
Scotty Young is going to do a panel on his whole process with The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
God, that's a great book.
Oh, Scotty's done an amazing job with that. And kicking off the day's events is a Hero Initiative Sketch Jam, 5-minute sketches by eight of our creators are going to be up there, and it's going to be a great time. Tom, you're doing that one, by the way. You're modding that panel.
I was going to ask you if you need me to moderate any of the other ones.
I think you're good. I think it's the Sketch Jam.
Such a go-along kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah. The Sketch Jam is going to be a high energy. I think I'm actually going to do the Richard Starkings panel, which will basically, me moderating the Richard Starkings panel will be,
you ask
Welcome,
Richard Starkings.
Richard, how are you doing?
You will ask Richard Starkings one question, and then he will talk
well,
for
Chris,
1 hour.
Let me tell you, back in 1972.
This is what happened, yeah.
And so I'm looking forward to that. So anyway, WindyCityComicCon.com. It is getting close, and we are getting excited about it. All right, I'm just going to jump to the end here. We have emails and voicemails, but we'll bump them to next week like we usually do. Leave an iTunes music review. Have fun. Enjoy comics. I want to thank everyone. Paul Mounts, Tony Akins, Tom, Mark Beatty for hosting us, as always, here at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles. Everyone, have a wonderful rest of your week and weekend. We will be back again next Monday with another full-length episode. In the meantime,
in between time,
we'll be everywhere in and around,
and around comics.
It's not scripted.
Every
week. Four years.
When I look upon my work, I cry.
247 episodes in a row.
248 episodes. 50 of them.
What are you doing for the big 250?
Oh, you're not spamming. In the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2009. Yeah.